This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
So in part one, which was released today, Brandon Webb explained, you know, what happened in Iraq, what happened in Afghanistan, how did it start? He was in the first group of Navy SEALs that was deployed to Afghanistan in November of 2001. He started the SEAL Sniper School. He runs a military information service. So he explained to us everything that was going on. You know, like, how the war in Iraq, quote unquote, ended. What's going on in Afghanistan? What happened in Afghanistan? And the stories he's seen back in over the past two decades. But now in this part two, what happened in this pullout? Why did it go so wrong? What's next? Here's Brandon Webb. So what's going on? So we decided to get out of Afghanistan a decade or so ago. Why didn't it happen immediately? What needed to happen for it to happen? And why did it happen now? And why did it go wrong?
Why no one stood up and said, what the hell we're doing? Why are we still in Afghanistan? And they didn't end it sooner. The only thing I could point to is just bad leadership and people that were afraid to speak up. And anytime you're in an organization where people that speak up, and there have been some officers that did speak up in the past, and they basically got shoved aside. And then you end up with this situation where you do need a balance of power. It's like everything looks like a nail to a hammer, right? So you put these generals and admirals in this combat arenas, and they're controlling these, you know, these areas. Like, they, of course they want to keep at it, you know? So I think that has something to do with it too. But can you think of anybody that went on CNN or Fox News that had stars on their shoulders that said, hey, we need to get out of Afghanistan. These are the reasons. There's no reason to be there. There's no strategic purpose to America. We're wasting trillions of dollars. Lives are being lost. Like, nobody stood up and said that. I can't think of one person. It was just this, like, you know, oh, we got to fight the global war on terror, you know?
Yeah. Why were they like that? Because, again, they're the ones with the most experience. I mean, did it give them meaning in life to be at war? And they were worried about just not, I mean, there's plenty of other military situations around the world, not just Afghanistan. Just what?
Yeah.
Why did they, I mean, well, then, okay. I can understand though, if they say, look, we're not ready because the Taliban's going to overrun us instantly. They supply the world's heroin and opium, and they're going to have all these weapons, and the Al-Qaeda is going to be back. I can understand if they said that. And then if they just said, we don't know what to do, you got to help us with, they had to be talking to someone else, help us create economic development in Afghanistan. And that's how we could pull out.
Yeah. I mean, that, and that obviously didn't happen. And that's, you know, what showed up to me. Like, it was no surprise to me when the pullout turned into what it did. And basically the Afghan army just handed the Taliban the keys, like, no fight. The president fled to the United Arab Emirates. It's because we never had a solid plan for Afghanistan. We didn't have a plan that would say, look, we're going to get the government and the military to a certain point, and then we're going to stage a pullout over a year or two that, you know, gets all the important people out of Afghanistan that need to be out of Afghanistan.
So what would you have done? And then we'll get to what actually happened. But let's say 2010, you're the president of the United States, and you really want to get people out of Afghanistan and reduce the military and so on. What would you have done?
I would have first went on television and briefed the military. Look, this is our plan. We're going to set a pullout date. We're going by this date. Whether it was, you know, 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, we're going to stabilize the government. We're as best as possible. We're going to, look at some economic incentives that we can put in place. But largely, like, we're not going to nation build. Like, we're going to turn over the country to the Afghans to let them rule however they see fit. And then we stage a slow methodical pullout. We gradually, you have a gradual troop drawdown. You start getting the people out of the country in a way that doesn't have people clinging onto aircraft landing gear and then falling to their deaths and mobs storming the airport. You just do it in a slow, planned out way. And you communicate the plan to everybody so they know, like, okay, in this date that we set, like this is the plan to pull out. And I would have left a small, you know, probably intelligence and special operations base that is in very much the way McChrystal successfully fought his war on terror. It was like, look, you don't need large conventional footprints. You have a small intelligence and special operations team that can kind of gather intelligence locally and then use a lot of air assets, right? The Predator drones. And
he was basically fired for saying this. So, if you were the president and you were coming up with your plan and I was playing devil's advocate, like let's say I'm one of these generals, I would say, look, you could do it slowly, but it's going to hit a tipping point where suddenly the Taliban's going to be aware that they can overrun us and Al-Qaeda is going to come back and we're going to have people hanging onto wheels trying to get out. Like there's no way to do it slowly, it seems, is my worry.
Well, the thing is they rush to pull everybody out. But you keep the military there, evacuate all the civilians. So you do have that military presence. And then you start slowly.
Yeah, why'd they take out the military before the civilians, knowing that there was danger? That seems like a low IQ thing.
That's a good question. Yeah. No, and I think that generally it's like you and I could probably have planned a better Afghan pullout than what the top military officials advised the president. And again, I think Biden has a lot of guts for sticking to his guns and saying we've been there too long. Like we need to come out. And it's unfortunate politically for him that it was egg on his face because the buck does stop with the president. But I don't fault President Biden. I'm like looking at this room full of these Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I'm like looking around the room on the internet virtually, going, God, these guys just aren't the sharpest tools in the shed. And again, you get this, you know what happens to organizations that have poor leadership at the top. They do not look for A players, right? They want to be the smartest person in the room. And so you get this leadership issue and culture that just breeds poor leadership. And I think generally that's what's happened.
Can you imagine the conversation though? Like, let's say Biden says to the generals, okay, I want to pull out and what should we do? And the generals reply, listen, let's get all the military out first and then we're out. And then this Biden says, well, there's like 10,000 civilians there who are American citizens. What should we do with them? And the general's like, don't worry. They'll buy a ticket home from American Airlines. Like, did that conversation happen or what? I don't even understand because it's so stupid to not get the civilians out first.
Yeah, I mean, they pushed heavily, but they rushed it, right? It was this like rush job. I read an article, I think the Washington Post today, about the CIA actually helping secretly get American civilians out of the country. There was an article, a story about a woman that they evacuated in today's paper. But I just, that's why I'm looking at this thing going, it's a complete disaster. And anytime a ship runs aground, there's somebody in charge, right? So I look at this going, okay, yeah, I get that the buck stops with the president, but really who was in charge of this, the planning and the execution? You know, you have the head of the intelligence agencies and the military, and I think it's a complete disaster. And it showcases how we have a big leadership problem right now in the U.S. military, culturally. And even I'll point to my own community, which I love the Navy SEALs. It was an incredible experience for me. But I looked at my own community being over-deployed, over-traumatized. These guys are coming back like I don't completely changed people. And in the SEAL community over the time I was out since 2006, so what's that, you know, over 14 years, I've seen issues that with war crimes, with they sent a whole SEAL platoon back from Iraq that were drunk and disorderly. Like, this is crazy stuff. Then you know, you have the, everybody knows about the Eddie Gallagher situation. I don't even blame Gallagher. Like,
What's the Eddie Gallagher situation?
He was like a SEAL that was brought up on war crime charges. And his platoon testified against him. Like, it was bad stuff all over the news media, New York Times. If you Google Eddie Gallagher. So all this stuff is happening. The SEALs got investigated by NCIS for stealing Captain Phillips' $30,000 in the lifeboat after they shot and killed the pirates holding him. It's like all this stuff. And then just, I think, earlier this year, the SEAL admiral in charge of war crimes says, you know what, I think we may have a cultural problem in the SEAL teams that we need to deal with. And I was just like face-palming myself going, you think we have a problem? Like, this is a serious, huge problem. And how could you not see that the cultural degradation and a community that was once, you know, one of the top military special operations community in the world, had just been over deployed, over traumatized, and had on many cases, you know, poor leadership. And then the admiral is like, oh, maybe we have a problem. You think?
I mean, so. even if you're willing to say, listen, we've kind of messed up. We didn't really nation build. We don't know how to do it. The Taliban's going to take back over and we'll see what happens. We'll hope for the best, but whatever. Even if you think that, you still would think, okay, we're going to pull out, but let's get the civilians out first. That's the part I don't really understand.
Yeah. No, it's a great question. One I would ask myself if I was in the White House press room.
Has any press conference asked Biden this?
I don't know. Yeah, I honestly don't know. But that's a great question. And then now you look at, you know, the thing that was going on behind the scenes that we also reported on at Sofra was the Chinese influence, right? Like, Chinese very publicly embracing the Taliban. What you don't see in public is their intelligence mechanism behind the Taliban. And basically, I think the reason that the Taliban took over the entire country so quickly is because they had the backing of the Chinese, both, you know, militarily, but also, you know, with the intelligence being provided and the fact that they knew they've got this ally in China. So the US is kind of like scurrying off and not itching to pick a fight with the Chinese. So China has more influence in the region.
And this is where I'm just like, maybe because I don't give a shit and like a lot of people do, but like, why does China care so much about having Afghanistan? Like, nobody, you know, Russia tried, obviously the US tried. China is being much more smooth about it. Like, they're giving money and intelligence and resources. They're not just invading them because they don't care about anything. They just want natural resources. But what do they want out of Afghanistan? Like, why do they care?
Yeah, that's a great question and something that we're digging in deeper. And I'm thinking about myself lately is why, other than more influence in the region, which seems to make sense. But at the core of it, like, what are they truly after? So there must be something or some things.
Well, are there like in Africa, they're giving a ton of money to every country. They're building roads and they're getting back. You know, A, they're getting back interest payments on the debt, and B, they're getting back natural resources, minerals. Like, China, like everybody, the whole world lives on rare earth minerals. Africa's one source. But does Afghanistan have a lot of these resources? Or maybe the Chinese want to be involved in the opium trade, you know, to the West or something. That could be. I don't know. Like, is their strategic plan here?
Yeah, I don't know. I would think natural resources, but I've heard the horror stories from Africa, right? From friends that from these some of these countries where the Chinese will come in and pave all these nice roads, and then 5 years the roads start crumbling, and the local government realizes we don't have any infrastructure to maintain what the Chinese have built, and it all starts falling apart. So that and they are brutal about Like anyone that's fans of Star Trek, I think of the Chinese, like the Borg. They just move in and just rape every natural resource, the fish, local fisheries. I actually have a classmate of mine, Thibaut. He's a young French guy that, through a long, funny story, ended up in Guinea and got, like, chased this girl that he fell in love with, quit his finance job in London, and parents were like, you're crazy. Ran to Guinea, got a mining permit, went back, spent a year trying to raise money to kind of use the permit to explore his territory to see if they had bauxite, which is what they make aluminum out of. Ended up raising the money. But nobody, everyone's like, Thibaut, what the hell do you know about mining? You're a finance guy. So he raised the money. They went back and they found there was a huge deposit of bauxite. And again, he got met with the same thing. Thibaut, well, what the hell do you know about mining? Meanwhile, the Chinese mining billionaire comes to Africa, says, I'm here for the bauxite. And the government of Guinea says, well, you can talk to the Saudi Royal Fund or whatever, or you can talk to this French kid. And he's like, give me the French kid's number. 4 months later, the mine was operational and he was partners with this Chinese mine. And they're about mined out. Like it was crazy how efficient they were. Because most people said it was going to take a year and a half to stand up a mine. And that guy was like, 4 months, that mine was operational with 10,000 miners.
That many small children were willing to work there?
I guess, yeah. But anyway, it's anyone's guess, really. But I think natural resources, influence, regional influence. And I think the Chinese are very smart about the way they do these kind of things. And hopefully, you know, they've learned a lesson from the Soviets and us, like in Afghanistan, especially.
We have to figure that maybe their strategy too is just to embarrass us. That's certainly a side benefit for all these things.
Absolutely. The thing I talked about in an article I wrote earlier this week was, I honestly think we need major political reform in America. Like we should honestly, in addition to like a long list of items like no gerrymandering, we should all be voting by phone. If we can bank by phone, why the hell can't we vote by phone? And
that's a good point.
I think we would be smart to actually, like, one, put term limits in place for the House and the Senate, but also I would extend the presidential term to an 8-year term. That gives the president long enough to kind of really think and develop strategic plans and not have to be worrying about running for re-election 18 months into a 4-year term, right? Because that it's like hard to plan long-term when you're constantly dealing with trying to run for re-election and all the distraction that is. And I think people would be more serious about voting. They're like, shit, this person is going to be in there for 8 years. Like maybe I should really do some homework. But I think, you know, in that scenario, Russia and China just can't wait out like a Trump in 4 years. You know, they can sit and wait and see what happens.
What's going to happen next? Like what? So we pulled out, it was a mess. And, you know, maybe Americans will forget it in a few months, but what's going to happen in Afghanistan next? And what troubles does this cause us or the world? Like, is Al-Qaeda coming back? Is ISIS coming back? Like what's going on?
Al-Qaeda really never went anywhere. And the Taliban have a long celebrated relationship with the Mujahideen, the religious fighters from the Middle East. I think the concern is, you know, how do we keep an ear to the ground in Afghanistan and keep an eye on potential terrorist threats, right? I think that's a big problem. But we do have a very capable intelligence collection machine, both in the CIA, NSA, and inside the Joint Special Operations Command. The military does have their own intelligence gathering capability as well, very effective. But that's what I would worry about. Like, how do we prevent Afghanistan from becoming another terror safe haven again? You know, and so maybe that's through some back channel talks with the Chinese. I don't know.
And you said
that's what I would be worrying about.
You say Al-Qaeda never really went anywhere. I thought they were pretty much destroyed, you know, in those first few years after we attacked Afghanistan.
I mean, we killed an awful lot of them, but, you know, Al-Qaeda's, I mean, it's almost like, you know, Al-Qaeda and the jihad are one and the same, right? So you have this, you know, you cut off one head and one, you know, three more heads grow back. So I just, like, philosophically, I don't think Al-Qaeda ever went anywhere. We killed a lot of the leadership, but there's all these like offshoots, right? Like in so many acronyms, I can't even keep track. You have Al-Qaeda Iraq, Al-Qaeda Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda here, Al-Qaeda there, Al-Qaeda Northern Africa. So it's quite confusing, but the whole point is the Taliban have a long relationship with terrorists, which what they would call freedom fighters, not terrorists. So that's the problem I see in Afghanistan. Like, how do we prevent it from being another terror hotspot like it was prior to the 9/11 attacks?
And how do we, or maybe we don't, like, maybe this is what's likely to happen.
Yeah. I mean, it could very well likely happen. I would be for sure trying to, like, we need to choose. Like, I think we have enough trade with China. It makes sense to kind of, you know, develop some better diplomatic relations with China, especially they're arguably, you know, the largest economy in the world now. So we should for sure be trying to make a friend out of China, or at least have a neutral kind of ally there. So I would be doing that for sure. But I would, you know, if I'm president, and I would say, look, it's time to kind of clean up our own backyard. I think I have heard a lot of good signals lately about, you know, this talk of how foreign policy has been off the rails, and now it's time to rein it back in. Because when you look at this 20-year anniversary of 9/11, like, is Afghanistan a better place than we found it? No. Is America in better shape since 9/11? I don't think so. Like, we have major issues at home with, you know, just the whole education system, which I know you're passionate about. Like, I think YouTube should be teacher of the year for America, because most of my kids, they learned what's valuable through practical experience. I remember my son, who's incredibly good at math, was like, God, when I turned over our self-storage business to him at 17 and said, this is going to be your new college job, he's like, how come they don't teach us how to do a P&L and a balance sheet in school? Like, these kids, you know, are preyed upon by the student lending system. We have massive issues with healthcare being so expensive. The insurance providers and big pharma kind of controlling the healthcare system, which is a disaster in the U.S. And then, you know, our economy. So it's like, we got big problems back home that we need to deal with before we can start policing the world again, or trying to promote the American agenda abroad.
Yeah, what even is the American agenda? I guess it's to...
Nobody knows.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
So like, given this, all right, you, it's a very bleak picture. And like you say, and, you know, it's not only a man's search for meaning, it's a country's search for meaning. And a country is made up of individuals, men and women, and we derive part of our meaning through patriotism and the philosophy of your country. That's why these elections have gotten so heated. And how do we live a good life, given that not only are mistakes made, they're not just made by one person, they're made by like a culture of people over decades. And we've kind of like drove ourselves into a corner, and it's hard to back out. Like, as an individual, how do you personally deal with it? Or how should I deal with it? Like, I deal with it by kind of not paying that much attention to the news. And I saw how angry people got during the election. It's just not worth it to me to be that angry ever. So how do you personally deal with the fact that things are a mess, that we have to, we're paying for it. We pay 60% of our income in taxes.
Yeah, for sure. So I, me personally, you know, I give several talks a year to certain groups, and inevitably somebody raises their hand and says, why don't you run for office? And I was like, look, I don't want to put myself and my family in that current system, which is terrible. Like, there's like nasty business of politics. I said, I think what I can contribute still to America, look, Safra, it's, you know, we get a million plus visitors a month. The reporters and journalists at Safra, they're all former military, and we work very hard to report as apolitically as possible. So I think, you know, hammering on these issues and, you know, staying on message and kind of contributing to the news cycle in a positive way, I think that I can make a difference that way.
What do you mean contributing to the news cycle?
Like, well, I mean, we've broken some major stories. Like, we broke a ton of news around Benghazi and really kind of what happened in Benghazi, which the average American public didn't know what the hell we were doing in Benghazi, Libya. Why did this Ambassador Stevens get his compound burned and he died of suffocation? And we're like, okay, well, look, here's what was happening with Benghazi. You have the State Department promoting diplomacy, running their own agenda. You have the CIA trying to capture these like loose weapons of mass destruction. You have a JSOC special operations team working directly for President Obama, running down a kill list of bad guys. JSOC was killing guys that were on the CIA payroll. So the CIA, so now you have a situation where these warlords in Benghazi are like, wait a minute, I thought my friend was cooperating with the Americans. They just kicked down his door and shot him in the face last night. So this whole thing, you know, CIA doesn't trust the State Department, vice versa. They're having to like make sure that they send message traffic by official courier, just so they can cover their ass. Then this whole thing bubbles up into a complete, it just spilled over. And then you have, you know, the British ambassador got an RPG sent right through his armor car, I think a week before Benghazi. And they're like, okay, time to get out. And the reason the RPG didn't go off is because the warhead has to spin a certain amount of times to arm itself. It was so close that it just went right through the vehicle.
Yeah. So again, though, this is bleak. And yes, you found meaning in reporting it because you feel these are stories that need to be told and we're not seeing them anywhere else. SofRep is your news service, SofRep.com. People should check it out. I check it out. For the average person or not so average person listening to this, what do we do to kind of keep calm instead of saying, oh, the world's over? Like, we're just going to get overrun by corruption and whatever.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm an optimist. Even the article I wrote, I have this habit of like, I feel like I can't complain about something unless I propose solutions to the problem. And so a lot of my own writing is like that. And that was a lesson I learned in the military. And as a new guy SEAL, I remember one of my mentors said, look, you know, you're not a new guy anymore. If you have an issue with something, always be prepared to present a solution or else keep your mouth shut. So I think, you know, we are doing a service. Like we've had subscribers back to 8 years since we first started Safra as a business. And they said, in the comments section, like, wow, I remember you guys telling us this could happen 4 or 5 years ago with Afghanistan. And here we are today. Like, how can I make a difference? And so I think the point is, you know, we have made a lot of positive difference with you're seeing things with happen in climate change and companies. The thing is, this isn't a solution that will be solved by government. That maybe used to be the way things can happen back in the 50s and 60s. We need everybody kind of doing what they can to make a difference. I think you've seen a lot of this happen in corporate America with women's equality, which needed to happen. The environment, you know, corporations are now taking stands, right? They're taking stands for social causes. And this kind of thing needs to continue to happen. like, how can this country let a two-party duopoly give us bad choices every 4 years? Like, we need massive election reform. Like, we're really counting paper ballots. Like, we're not voting by phone.
So there are
a lot of things that you can do.
Yeah. So I get it. Actually, it's clear. Like, you're saying awareness on an individual level is the key, and it's not like any one individual is going to change the world. But if the awareness builds, and we all are able to communicate with each other and continue building that awareness, then again, there'll be a tipping point and things will start to happen. We're not at that tipping point yet, but awareness is certainly building. Particularly, I think the fact that this election was so heated and controversial, whatever side you're on, whether you were for Biden, whether you're for Trump, the extremists on both sides were like animals. And I think that created a lot of awareness when 200 million, you know, voting Americans said, whoa, this trend has to go the other way at some point. Like, it's not healthy.
Yeah.
I hope they said that, you know, at least I said that, but I hope others did as well. And I think many did. So, but anyway, Brandon, this is like the 80th time you've been on the podcast. Last time was just a few weeks ago for your novel, your first novel, Steel Fear. Yeah. How's the novel doing?
It's doing great. We're getting great reviews. I talked to Ben Smith, our producer who did all the Jason Bourne movies. I talked to him this Wednesday about getting the series we sold to Peacock. So hopefully we kick off the filming in 2022 and get the series going. John and I just finished book two. So we turned
into
draft.
Gosh. When's that coming out?
It'll come out next year sometime. We don't have an exact date, but it'll be next year. So excited about that. And some good stuff. We got a great Navy SEAL scene. I just wrote the final fight scene, so it's pretty intense.
Oh, excellent. How do you write a fight scene without making it too, he hit him and then he hit him?
Well, when I wrote the final scene, I'm like, okay, you know, I plotted it all out. Like, you build the plot mount. I'm like, okay, well, I know how this is going to end. So how do I get to the ending? And I thought, okay, well, there's got to be guns involved. So it's guns, edged weapons, hand-to-hand, dirty hand-to-hand combat. And so kind of like working through those scenarios to get to the final, just like raw, animalistic, you know, face-to-face fight scene is pretty intense.
I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, it's a good one.
and also, you've been on the podcast for many of your other books, The Killing School, which was your book about starting the sniper school in the SEALs, your book Mastering Fear, The Red Circle, Total Focus, and others. So people should check out your stuff. But in particular, I really enjoy SofRep, SofRep.com to get as a news source. It's a real news source. And Brandon, thanks for explaining this to me, because like, I feel like most people, I sort of know what's going on, but it's been going on for 20 years. So you kind of lose track of the details. And you don't even want to, you get to a point where like, oh my gosh, is that still happening? Like, I don't even want to hear about that anymore. Yeah. But, you know, it was thrown in our face basically the month of the 20th anniversary of 9/11. So I wanted to know more. And thank you for explaining to me and all the listeners. I super appreciate it. Plus explaining Iraq and what was going on there.
Yeah.
So
no, I appreciate part of the change is this podcast itself, right? Like, you have a huge, huge fan base. And I think many will be surprised to hear my thoughts on the whole situation. Because, you know, when we were living in New York a long time ago,
decades ago,
people would be shocked. They're like, wow, you're not this like crazy right wing, you know, pull my handgun from my cold dead fingers kind of guy. And so this is part of the bias I'm trying to address is look, they're, you know, we have problems out there. So I appreciate you having me on the show so I could explain at least my own experience from what's happened. Because I think this is a perspective many people need to hear on both sides.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, thanks again, Brandon. And of course, we will see you again soon.
Thanks for having me.